I make the point that as a gynecologist, I help women with the physical, hormonal, and medical aspects of sexual response, eliminate sexual pain, and help women who can't orgasm due to maybe an SSRI, diabetes, or vascular disease. I'm not a therapist. I don't treat the psychosocial aspects of sexual difficulties or address the mind-body connection. But I've always been lucky because I have access to talented sex therapists that I can collaborate with, and I couldn't do my work without them. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Lori Brado is the Paul McCartney of the sex therapy world, a real rock star. Even my daughter, sex therapist Dr. Rachel Czar, who many of you have heard speak on my Come Again audio series, was impressed that she was going to be my guest. Dr. Brado is a professor in the University of British Columbia Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and her research focuses on developing and testing psychosocial interventions for women's sexual and pain-related difficulties. In addition to being a regular on the academic conference circuit, she's the author of Better Sex Through Mindfulness and has appeared on many documentaries and is a regular guest on other popular podcasts. And today, she's going to join me to talk about how mindfulness and CBT is the missing piece of the puzzle for women struggling with sexual difficulties. And most exciting, her new innovative digital product that's designed to be used by women who don't have access to a Lori Brado. So welcome, Lori.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Well, I'm excited to be sitting here with you because truly you've been a household name for me. So this is terrific. All right. So not everyone has a sex therapist for a daughter. I would like you to start by talking about the role of a sex therapist and specifically CBT and mindfulness, what they are, how they work in terms of helping women who have a lack of desire.
Yeah, I mean, I think you articulated it so beautifully right off the top that the mind and body are connected in all aspects of our health and well-being. Everything we think has a physiological counterpart in the body. Similarly, what happens in our body is associated with certain thoughts and feelings. And so at the outset, I think it's really important that we do away with this idea that, you know, the mind is doing its own thing and the body is somewhat disconnected doing its own thing. And I think nowhere else is that especially pertinent than in the domain of sexual health, where we know that thoughts can impact how aroused we get. In turn, if we feel close to orgasm, that affects how we feel. Are we feeling elated? Are we feeling excited? Are we feeling dread? More specifically to your question on the role of a sex therapist, I think, you know, so many of us who are at the front lines providing care to women with sexual concerns, we recognize that our toolboxes need multiple options that are evidence-based. In the same way that I'm housed within a department of OBGYN, I work shoulder to shoulder along my physician colleagues and recognize the vital role that, you know, pharmaceuticals and physiological and medical approaches take. We also recognize that sex therapists who can really ask those detailed questions about a person's feelings, thoughts, their history, their well-being is a really important part. So CBT and mindfulness in particular are two tools, two psychological approaches that have been studied a fair bit when it comes to their role in addressing sexual health concerns in women. And I've been fortunate enough to, for the last almost 25 years, be doing research on those two particular approaches. They work differently. But they are both very evidence-based in terms of improving things like desire, arousal, ability to reach orgasm, and even vulvovaginal pain. And so, you know, when we talk about evidence-based approaches to address these sexual health concerns in women and in men, although I know today our conversation is focused on women, we really want to consider, would CBT and or mindfulness be an option for this person?
Okay. And we're going to talk a little bit more later on about what a woman experiences who is doing CBT or mindfulness therapy. But I thought we'd start out with an example, a really, really common example. So woman comes to me, she's been married for 37 years to a guy that she actually still likes and is still attracted to. But they stopped having penetrative sex when she was 52, the usual vaginal dryness, pain, and they remained affectionate, but not sexual. So 10 years later, she comes to see me, and as expected, severe changes due to genitourinary syndrome of menopause, those hormonal changes that cause vulvar vaginal dryness and thinning that make intercourse pretty much out of the question. Well, my part is super straightforward. I treat her with vulvar and vaginal local vaginal estrogen. I refer to one of my amazing pelvic floor physical therapists. And a few months later, she tells me that despite the fact that she can now easily place a penis-sized dilator in her vagina without pain and without fear, and has even had pain-free intercourse a couple of times, she has zero desire for sexual activity. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about your role in this scenario. Ideally, in a perfect world, when do you come into the picture and what do you do?
Yeah, it's such a common scenario, and certainly one that I love working with the kind of patient that you just described, because again, it's a perfect illustration of how, you know, a physician expert and a psychologist or sex therapist can work together. So, you know, one of the first things that I would do is I would ask her to tell me about a recent encounter, whether it was an encounter where she proceeded on and did have sexual activity, or maybe much more typical, it's an encounter where a partner makes an invitation and she declines it. And I would ask her to kind of walk me through step by step. Where were you? Paint the context. What were you thinking? What emotions were you sensing? What was happening in your body? So as you notice your partner start to walk towards you, you know, sometimes women who might have low desire or a fear of the situation for any number of reasons, including vulvovaginal pain, will start to brace. Inadvertently, they may not even know that they're holding tension in their body. And we actually know a fair bit about the role of sympathetic nervous system activation, that stress, fight or flight stress response system, and what happens when our body engages in it, in diluting or turning off altogether the potential for desire and arousal. So I'd really want to get a firsthand snapshot of what's happening moment by moment. And then as that kind of situation is unfolding, in turn, what are her ongoing thoughts? So the first thought might be, uh-oh, partner's approaching me, right? And then from there, it's partner wants sex. I can tell by just looking in their eyes. And of course, a CBT, a cognitive behavioral therapy approach, would involve some gentle challenging of that. How do you know that your partner wants sex? Have they declared it emphatically? Is there a possibility that there's another interpretation of that? And then we also work on techniques to relax the body. And then very, very importantly, we challenge avoidance behavior, because if we avoid a situation like that, it's going to reinforce the beliefs. All my partner wants is sex. I can't deliver because I've lost my arousal and I've lost my desire. And, you know, my relationship is doomed. That's obviously a much more catastrophic example, and it might be a more diluted form of that. So again, first and foremost, in any kind of biopsychosocial assessment, is really understanding what's happening in the moment.
This isn't just for people who are in a relationship. This is also for people who are not currently in a relationship, but who are perhaps in avoidance mode.
Absolutely. We actually, so my other hat as an academic is, we actually looked at that question. We looked retroactively at a number of our studies that have been evaluating either a mindfulness-based intervention or CBT, and we compared the single women to the women who are in relationships. And then we also looked at things like relationship duration to address this question, you know, are those unpartnered women, are they especially disadvantaged from these mm-hmm. kinds of approaches that often rely on involvement of a partner? And the answer is no. And so these kinds of approaches can work just as well for single women. And in fact, I would argue perhaps even better, because avoidance is so strong. They don't want to put themselves out there. They're turning down the first date because, again, the catastrophic brain fast forwards to date number 3, date number 5, date number 10. And what do I do when the situation arises and it's time for sex? And how do I tell them I have no desire whatsoever?
You know, one of the things that's so important about your work and the reason why you're so respected in the field is because it is academic, it is data driven. And too often that's not the case when we get to, you know, the psychosocial world, if you will. So when it comes to CBT and mindfulness, can you talk about the data in terms of how beneficial it is in women who have low sexual desire? And just to keep things a little simpler, let's assume that this is a woman who is not also struggling with painful sexual activity. This is sure. just the woman who is, you know, once she starts to have sexual activity, she actually has pleasure. She right. maybe even enjoys it. She yeah. just isn't thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I often credit the approval and advent of Viagra to really igniting this field of sex research in women, you know. So, but it also means that it's a fairly recent field where we've seen a lot of intensity in a short amount of time. So since about 2000, we've seen quite a number of randomized trials evaluating either mindfulness or CBT. And I'll talk about those a little bit separate because they are different approaches. And I know we'll kind of get into the nuts and bolts of it later. But CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, I think was one of the earlier interventions to really be studied scientifically because it's quite easy to manualize, right? You can write an 8 or 10 session manual that outlines here are the things to cover in general. Obviously, we, as a skilled therapist, there's a lot of nuance and there's going to be particularities of that person and their history that you need to adapt. But in general, you know, we teach them how to identify problematic thoughts. We then talk about avoidance behavior. We teach progressive muscle relaxation. So it was one of the earlier approaches to be studied. And there was actually a large meta-analysis that was published over 10 years ago that found CBT, so typically 8-session structured CBT for women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder or distressing low desire, had an effect size, and I'll talk about effect size because I think that's a, you know, a metric that many of us can understand regardless of your statistical approach, of about 0.8. Now, just to put it in perspective, most psychological treatments are lucky if they see an effect size of 0.4. So, you know, moderate range.
And it takes a lot longer than 8 to 10 weeks, I'm just saying.
Correct. Correct. I mean, that's exactly
I'm
right.
Impressed, though,
yeah. So that's when we look at cognitive behavioral therapy. So we consider it to be, you know, among the first line approaches when we're addressing low desire. Mindfulness now, on the other hand, and I was actually really lucky to be one of the first to apply mindfulness to women's sexual health concerns. When I was learning about mindfulness, I was a resident at the University of Washington, a psychology resident, and I was learning about mindfulness for a totally separate condition. And I was doing research with cancer survivors with sexual health concerns. And it just struck me that this approach might be really useful for these cancer survivors who felt quite disconnected from their sexual response. So that was 2002. Now, fast forward to 2026, we've had a large number of randomized controlled trials where the control group is either no treatment or an education only or CBT. And the effect sizes for mindfulness are even higher. So even in our own recent study, we found an effect size of about 0.9 to 1.0. So very, very high. And really importantly, in either of those conditions, CBT or mindfulness, once women learn the skills, they continue practicing them. And I think this is a real, you know, feature of psychological approaches. It's not that, you know, when you stop your 8 to 10 weeks of treatment, you kind of revert back to your prior functioning. You learn skills that you then continue to apply, not just to the sexual domain, but to other facets of your life.
I think most people are not really clear on a practical level. How are mindfulness and CBT different? Just if you could give us even just a sentence on what mindfulness is, yeah, as opposed to what CBT is.
Yeah, yeah. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a structured approach that changes how you feel by targeting what you're thinking and behaviorally what you're doing, right? So we do things like monitor catastrophic beliefs. So an example would be, I'm incapable of getting aroused, or my partner will leave me if my desire doesn't come back. These really potent, catastrophic beliefs. And we target them and challenge them. And when you change them, because we know beliefs can change, none of us were born with the beliefs that we have. So they're quite amenable to changing and challenging. When you do that, your emotions change. Similarly, the B part of CBT is behavior. We target avoidance. We target stress in the body, the sympathetic nervous system arousal, using evidence-based strategies like diaphragmatic breathing and countering avoidance. And in turn, emotions change. So that's kind of the premise. If you imagine this triangle, you're targeting thoughts and behaviors as a way of changing emotions. That's CBT in a nutshell, whether you're using CBT for sex or CBT for depression or CBT for anxiety.
How about for getting on a plane if you have a fear of flying? Just asking for someone.
Exact same thing. And I have many times been that person on the plane that's been doing diaphragmatic breathing with the person beside me who's hyperventilating.
Good. You're invited on my next flight.
So contrast that with mindfulness, and I'll try and give a kind of succinct definition of mindfulness. It's about paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. So part of it is attention training. You're focusing attention on the here and now, as opposed to five steps ahead. Am I going to get aroused? Will this end in, you know, disaster or pleasure? So you're focusing on the here and now, but you're doing so with lots of compassion and non-judgment. And that means if the mind escapes you, as our minds often do, we get very distracted. You say, oh, my mind is taken off. Come back to the present moment. It derives from Eastern Buddhist practices, but it really is a secular practice that's accessible to anyone, regardless of, you know, your religious affiliation or not, or age. And again, has been found to be very effective for things like managing stress, depression, anxiety, attention problems, child behavior problems. And then our team has really pioneered its adaptation to sex. And now many others around the world are using it as well.
Yeah. But that's really helpful, because very often they are lumped together and they're not the same thing.
They're not the same. Yeah. And we have ways of identifying, and this is where our research has been really helpful in looking at who might be the woman who does better with a CBT approach versus a mindfulness approach, because they are quite different. You know, CBT is very action-oriented and looking forward. Mindfulness is about being right where you are.
Yeah.
Right.
And just like the treatment that I do, you know, people think that there's, you know, what's the best thing for this? And there is no best thing. It's very
correct.
Individualized, because there's so many factors that are going to contribute to what's going on. You know, you treat women of all ages, of course, and in all phases of life, but we're focusing on perimenopause and menopause. And when we look at low libido in women who are in peri and postmenopausal, it's, as you know, incredibly, incredibly multifactorial. Not only are we dealing with the changes in the brain from neurotransmitters that kind of depend on those estrogen receptors, but also the downstream impact of everything else going on, you know, the hot flashes, the painful sex, even the SSRI that maybe someone put them on. So can you talk about how you navigate that?
Yeah. You know? So part of that early, really careful assessment and understanding the woman's picture is understanding what's in it for her, right? So why have that question of why have sex? And it's such an important place to start, because if she cannot think of a single reason that is rewarding for her, for why she should, you know, carve the time out and, you know, put the kids away and turn the phone off and do all of the other things that are really important for showing up and being present, then it will not be a priority. And I think it's something that so often gets overlooked in the therapy setting, is we kind of take for granted that people, you know, want, but they may not necessarily. And so asking those questions, what are your reasons for sex? And this also has been a huge area of research called the approach avoidance model. And one of the things we learned from it is if a woman is only having sex to avoid something negative, so to avoid a fight, avoid a belligerent partner, avoid consequences, that's a fast track to resentment. And I would advise couples therapy. For that couple, not even sex therapy, but couples therapy. Yeah. So you help her understand like what might be in it for her, even though she's not feeling desire in the moment. Maybe it helps her get to sleep better. Maybe it helps her feel confident the next day. Maybe, you know, it's to celebrate a birthday, even though she may not be feeling desire in the moment. And I've been influenced quite a bit by the writing of Rosemary Bisson and others who've written about this kind of circular sexual response cycle, which normalizes it for a lot of women. They don't have desire at the outset, and that's okay. Yeah, there has to be a want-to-want.
Yeah, and I think my point, Lori, is yes to everything that you said, but also I think we recognize that the literature is quite clear that there is a very high association of women who have menopausal symptoms and a lack of desire, even if they do express a personal desire to have desire, to want to have sex. So I guess what I'm saying is in my work, I am very much aware of the work that you do, that a sex therapist does. Not you specifically, but do you think that most sex therapists who are trying to help women with low desire are aware that they're kind of fighting an uphill battle if they don't get that woman to deal with her hot flashes, her lack of sleep, and her dry vagina? You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
I'm
just, I completely know what you're saying.
How important it is to collaborate with both of our worlds, because a lot of people don't, both therapists and women who are going through it.
Yeah. And I think it explains why, you know, I and folks like me are give so many talks to our sex therapy colleagues, which is emphasizing, look, this is a team approach. And if the woman is being woken up 15 times in the middle of the night from hot flashes, and she's got pain throughout her body, and there's you know, fatigue, and there's depression, you know, mindfulness is not going to get you that far. And so we absolutely have to be working shoulder to shoulder with our medical colleagues in this space. And admittedly, I will say that there are some, you know, sex therapists that are blind to the importance of that. But again, even the most effective psychological treatments, the high effect sizes I mentioned earlier, they're not going to get very far if there's real medical, hormonal, physiological factors that are making it impossible for this woman to be present and be sexual.
Yeah. I'm also curious, you'd mentioned earlier about pharmacologic options for libido. So give me your take on the use of testosterone, systemic testosterone, to help women who are postmenopause who are having issues with libido.
Yeah, I mean, I think the data are really clear. In trial after trial, we've seen testosterone compared to placebo be very effective for improving sexual desire in postmenopausal women. It's unfortunate that it's not approved in the US or in Canada where I live, and it leaves doctors to kind of, you know, work their magic on the back end and figure out the right formulation for women. But I think it plays a critical role. And often the women that I see, they've either tried testosterone, had some benefit, and now realize, oh gosh, I have a history of abuse that I've never addressed in my entire life. And I have flashbacks about this. And testosterone was great in giving me some of that physical oomph again, but I've got traumatic memories. So that's a very common scenario. And I have a lot of my physician colleagues who will refer to me in that situation. But I've also been in the opposite situation where I've used every effective psychological treatment under the sun at my disposal. And it's not made a whole lot of a difference for a particular person. And so I am not shy at all to suggest a pharmacological approach like testosterone.
Yeah. But what I have found in my clinical experience is that, first of all, the data, while it shows it is absolutely beneficial, we're looking at about 50% of women that it can be beneficial. And my clinical experience is very clear that the women who do the best on testosterone are the women who are also seeing a couples or a sex therapist at the same time. And the way I look at testosterone is it's a nice kickstart. It can prime the pump in a lot of women, but it is not the whole story. And I think that, again, you know, just as we're talking about mind body, testosterone is certainly going to trigger those receptors that are in the brain that are going to get things moving again, but not for everybody. And it sure works a whole lot better when there's a therapist in the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there may be the sort of one-off scenario where it may make things worse because she's noticing, oh, I have a more of a physical kickstart to my desire. But again, there's so many other issues that are complicating the situation that's making it more frustrating for me. So, you know, a lot of nuance, a lot of tools in the tool belt, and if at all possible, having your multidisciplinary team around.
In a perfect world.
You know, I know.
Nothing would make me happier than if we could give someone, you know, a little testosterone, a little flibanserin, Eddie, or bremelanotide, Veozah, you know, one of these drugs, and problem solved.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect world. Yeah. So speaking of it's not a perfect world, I am really, really excited to talk about your latest brainchild, eSense, because you know better than anyone that everyone does not have access to a certified sex therapist who has expertise in CBT and mindfulness. And you've already established how important these modalities are. So talk to us. Talk to us about eSense, your new digital tool.
Yeah, super exciting. So Kyle Stevenson, who's my co-founder with eSense, and he's really an expert in CBT and has done a lot of research and trials in CBT for sexual dysfunction. We came together a decade ago and said, you know, we have these evidence-based psychological treatments, but women, so many women are not accessing them for a variety of reasons, right? Sex therapists are expensive. They might live in a rural or remote town. They might have so much shame and stigma that they can't even bring themselves to make that phone call to a sex therapist. The list goes on and on. You know, this was certainly riding the wave of other digital technologies for things like managing, you know, tracking your menstrual cycles or tracking your eating behaviors. And so we said, why can't we do the same thing with our sex therapy approaches, where we develop a tool that really mimics what would happen if you were to walk into the office of a great sex therapist, and it would sort of simulate what would happen session by session. Now, there's other sexual health apps that are on the market, things like OMG Yes and other ones, but they're really designed to provide good information about sex and debunk myths and give you some ideas about pleasure, but they're not designed to really deliver sex therapy.
So this is not educational. There is education involved, but it is primarily a therapeutic process.
That's exactly right. So the portal itself, when you go into it, you can choose either cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness. And we've got some videos and some brief questionnaires to help a woman decide if she doesn't know. And so we can guide her as to which of those two arms. Within each of those two arms, there's 8 modules. And so within a module, there's videos where I explain concepts like responsive desire or how mindfulness works, or provide an example of thought challenging. There's homework sheets, there's downloadable meditation files, there's real women that you follow through session by session, and you kind of watch what happens as they practice the exercises and struggle with the exercises. There's tip sheets, and then on top of it, every woman gets a navigator. And a navigator is someone that we train on the team that gives them a bit of validation and support. And the research tells us that other digital health approaches that have a navigator, someone to just kind of be a little bit of a listening ear for a few minutes a week, and increases adherence to eSense. So we've published quite a number of studies on feasibility, usability. We then did a large randomized trial where we compared each of the two arms of eSense to a waitlist control group. Again, found that it worked very, very well. 87% saw a significant improvement in their desire and reductions in distress. And most recently, in early 2026, we've launched a commercial pilot where we're really looking at, okay, it works very well in the research academic environment where things are tightly controlled. What happens when, you know, women try this out in the real world? And so far, the data are looking really great. We're going to use that feedback to make some final refinements. And then hopefully by the end, the second half of 2026, eSense will be available. So we've had several hundred clinics reach out to us and say, this would be a great tool for us, again, to deliver alongside the hormonal treatment that we're doing, or the pharmacologic approaches, or other treatments. And this is really the missing piece for them. So it really is about bringing the treatment to women so that they can use it in a way that is right for them. And again, it's exciting because I think it's the first of its kind in terms of a sex therapy digital tool.
No, it's extraordinarily exciting because, you know, we are well aware in this world how limited the access is, not just to sex therapists, but to sex therapists who do have expertise in CBT and mindfulness. And the other thing I want to emphasize is while you're talking about this as a tool that any woman can choose to do, it's not just for women who don't have access to a sex therapist. It's for women who are maybe seeing a sex therapist. I know my daughter's talked about using this tool with patients that she's working with. And like you said, something that they can do on their own. And I'm assuming that once someone has eSense, that they can return to the modules. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, let's say they go through the course, they go through the 8 modules and things are pretty good. And then they're often doing their own thing. And then 6 months later, 8 months later, they find that they're slipping back. They can return.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so sometimes these tools, especially if, let's say, practicing a body scan is brand new to you, you know, you need to practice it to retain those skills. In the same way, I mean, I love gym analogies. You don't do a good 12-week gym program and then you're set for the rest of your life. No, we need a maintenance program where we're using these skills. And maybe you see a trainer and you refine your method and you make sure that you're lifting in the proper way. And I think use of psychological skills works in exactly the same way. You're going to get a big burst of new learning, implementing changes in your life. And then there's going to be a maintenance program after that. One of the other exciting things with eSense that I'll mention is we have a number of side trials underway where we've adapted eSense to other populations. So as an example, we've just finished a large trial with an adapted version to cancer survivors, where we know that they have many of the same sexual concerns that non-cancer survivors have. But in addition to that, there's changes in body image. There's changes in, let's say, a partner dynamic. When a partner moves from being from a lover to a caretaker for a period of time while a woman's undergoing treatment. So we worked with cancer survivors to adapt eSense to that population, mm-hmm. tested it, and now we're just about to analyze the data for that. And then we are just starting to work on a version for women with provoked vestibulodynia or vulvovaginal pain as well.
So back to the cancer survivors, I'm hoping that we're not talking just about breast cancer survivors, but all cancer survivors, because too often people focus on breast cancer survivors, but the other women feel kind of forgotten. I mean, the most common cancer in women is lung cancer. We have colon cancer. We have anal cancer. And no matter the cancer, people are doing better. Great. People are surviving. Wonderful. But then we're looking at quality of life. And too often, those women, they're not addressed because everyone is so focused on breast cancer.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, and that's why in our trial we're making an effort to really reach out to the oncologists that maybe talk about sex less often, like the hematologists and others, where we know things like graft versus host disease, and there's pain, and then that impacts sexual desire. Colorectal cancer, where there may be very, very significant body image issues due to concerns about leakage and other things like that. And I think those are the survivors that are sadly sometimes are not thought about first and foremost, like breast cancer or gynecologic cancers are.
Yeah, they're really forgotten and they really struggle. And I'm thrilled that you are including those folks. And then you kind of threw out there, you mentioned the vestibulodynia crowd.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know who Andrew Goldstein is.
Very well.
And I think it was 4 weeks ago, he was my guest talking about some of the innovative research that he is doing. So for anyone who is listening, who has vestibulodynia, vulvodynia, which is extraordinary pain, both sexual and non-sexual, on the vulva and specifically on the opening to the vagina, the vestibule, please go back and take a listen to that. And then access Dr. Brado's information, because we talked a little bit on that pod as well about how important it is to get the psychological support after having years for many of these women, chronic pain. We've talked about the painful sex population and the cancer population, but it goes beyond that when we look at different populations of women. Could you touch on some of the other populations that you focused on? you know, there's a lot of women out there who are really struggling.
So many. So I'll give you two examples, one with PTSD, because we actually have a publication that came out last year on this topic. And we know that among women who are seeking treatment for sexual concerns, they have a higher prevalence of having a history of sexual assault or sexualized violence of any sort. So in our eSense randomized trial, half of our participants had a history of sexual assault. And so one of the questions we asked was, you know, did they do worse? Because on top of, you know, the impacts on desire and arousal, they might have mild PTSD symptoms. They might have dissociation or flashbacks or other things like that. So we did some in-depth analyses comparing those two groups, so the women with versus without a history of sexual abuse, and actually found that there was no difference. In other words, the women with a history of sexual abuse did just as well. And in addition, we measured PTSD symptoms in our eSense randomized trial and saw a reduction in PTSD symptoms. So it's very interesting because so often as a sex therapist, if a patient comes into my clinic and she has unresolved sexual abuse and PTSD symptoms, I might often recommend that she do some of that work first before we pursue sex therapy. And our data suggest that there may be another route for these women, and something like eSense that actually does also address trauma within the program can address both at the same time. So I think that's super exciting because that group suffers a lot. They really, really do, because they might be in a relationship that's totally consensual. They want to be having sex. And then the earliest signs of arousal can trigger a flashback or trigger dissociation. Yeah.
And what makes it really, really complicated is how few people really appreciate even the definition of sexual abuse. Because I think when you talk about sexual abuse, women are like, well, that's not me. I was never raped. You know, I never had non-consensual sex, even though it was one out of four women have something like that. But it goes beyond that, which is why a lot of women don't recognize that they're in that group. So could you fill us in on sexual abuse that's not how many women think of it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think how you've just described that makes it important for sex therapists or people like me to ask the right questions. Because if the question is, have you been raped? You know, women sort of have this maybe singular idea, well, that didn't happen to me, or I think I consented, and they'll be more likely to say no. And so the questions have to, first of all, there needs to be a multitude of questions. You know, have you ever been in a situation where maybe you engaged in anything sexual, intercourse, touching, kissing, where you didn't give full consent? And that includes being under the influence of alcohol. That includes being with someone who's many years older than you. That includes maybe you were a student and this was a teacher. So that kind of power differential example where we know that we actually can't legally give consent in a situation like that, where there is that power differential between people. So really important to ask questions in different ways. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of, very sadly, is online sexual harassment. And often women don't see that as sexual assault or sexual abuse, but it indeed meets the criteria. When you look at the effect on women's thoughts, belief systems, emotions, trauma responses, in some ways, online sexual harassment can be even worse because it's so pervasive. It's not immediately evident that it, you know, is abuse per se, and yet it can be incredibly harmful. So really important that we have kind of this broad understanding of, you know, what this might look like, and ask our questions in a very sensitive way. Also recognizing that a person may not tell you the first time you meet them. Right. So don't try and cram all of these really important questions into the very first assessment and have an idea that, okay, we're done, we can move on. Our assessment, the data that we collect, continues over every session that we see a woman.
The other group that I'd like to touch on are women who, because of a specific cultural or religious background, have a difficult time with sexuality. Does eSense speak to that?
Yeah, so I live in Vancouver, which, you know, we have over 50% of our population are ethnically and culturally and religiously diverse. So that certainly reflects my own clinical practice here. And I've worked hard to kind of increase my own learning from those cultural groups around how to deliver sex therapy in a culturally safe way. So within the eSENS trial, we worked hard to have a diverse group. That includes ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, but also women who were living in rural and remote areas where we know that not only is it harder to get a sex therapist, but their basic medical care might be more challenging because, you know, there's one primary care doc for the entire town. And this person is doing double, triple duty as being a generalist as well as a specialist. And so the feedback that we had, so we had a number of questionnaire measures, but then also interviews that we gave, that we invited women to do, was that they loved eSENS because they could access it regardless of where they lived. They could use AI to do some translation in parts that, you know, might have been more difficult to understand. Although I should emphasize, when we developed eSENS, we were around the table with patients, with women with lived and living experience, writing all the content together. It was essential to us that it was written in a jargon-free way, that it was accessible language that was understandable to even someone for whom English was not their first language. And in it, we do talk about the role of cultural factors and religion, as well as, you know, all the other factors that can impact how we feel this are. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Walk me through a woman who says, okay, I'm really excited about this. I'm interested in this. So walk me through how someone accesses it and what their experience is actually going to be. You mentioned eight modules. How long is each module? When we say interactive, are they, you know, how is it interactive? How are they interacting with the material?
Great question. So eight modules, and in our studies, we've actually measured how long it takes women to go through it. We found that in the randomized trial, it took women about 11 weeks, and it's because, you know, you do the module, and then there's homework to do afterwards, and it's really the homework where the rubber hits the road in terms of putting these skills into action and then making those changes in the brain to incorporate those
Okay,
new
give an
behavioral
example of
patterns.
homework, because
So there, it's going to be different in the two arms. So I'll give you an example in the mindfulness arm, first of all. And one example is the body scan, which we introduce right at the beginning. And the body scan is a 20-minute practice. So they log into eSense, they get into their module, and then they click play on the audio recording. They close their eyes, they sit in their seat, and they hear my voice walking them through a 20-minute body scan. And a body scan in mindfulness, it's not about tensing and relaxing and trying to do something. It's about bringing awareness to the various parts of the body and doing so in a non-judgmental way. And so then you'll hear my voice provide instruction when your mind takes off, when you get distracted, when you hear the fire truck outside, compassionately bring it back to the same body part that we were just focusing on.
Like a specific body part. Like you'll
Yeah,
say,
I will say
think about your nose.
the middle toe on the left foot. It's that, it's in that amount of detail. And it's because we want, so the basic premise of mindfulness is we want awareness of sensations, bare sensations. And that's also why it works so well for pain, because pain, the word pain itself conjures up meaning and messages and images. But if we can focus on pain as, you know, an intensity, a pressure, a vibration, a heat, et cetera, distress goes down. It's fascinating literature that shows when you actually move closer into sensations, the kind of affective reaction to it changes. So in the body scan, they listen to the recording. And then over the course of that week, we encourage them to practice it as many times as possible. And within the
Without the recording
module,
or with the recording?
with the recording,
With the
with the
recording.
recording, especially if they're brand new to it, having the guide is really important. Then there's places where they can track how often they practice. Did they make it through the whole recording? What were their observations in it? And that's just one exercise in one module. And then in the mindfulness arm, we kind of layer on top of that. So we start with mindfulness practices on their own, and then we gradually introduce those practices into a partnered context where maybe they're doing some touching exercises like a sensate focus with their partner, and they're doing the same thing, applying the same skills. So on the CBT arm, which again is a different psychological approach. We would teach them how to, first of all, track their thoughts. So we would say, over the next week, in any scenario that you perceive as being sexual, and maybe it's, you know, it's 5 o'clock and your partner walks in the kitchen and they give you a look. And in that moment, you have a thought, uh-oh, are they inviting me to have sex? And so we ask them, first of all, to start tracking their thoughts and not filtering them. So just write out or type out. And within eSense, they can actually insert their information directly into the program, or they can download separate PDFs on their computer where they enter the information. So we give them that flexibility depending on how comfortable they are. And then the exercises on top of that, we walk them through multiple examples of how do you challenge a thought, right? Mm-hmm. How do you find alternative evidence that would suggest that maybe that thought isn't entirely true, or there's some nuance to that thought? And then we build on it from there. So over the course of a week, it would take about an hour and a half of working through the actual program and doing the exercises. And on average, it takes about 11 weeks. What we're finding in our cancer survivor samples, especially if a woman has had chemotherapy that makes it more difficult to say to concentrate, it's taking a few weeks longer. And so we've built in some extra cushions around that.
You know, as you were talking about this, one of the things that came to mind is that your book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, you also have a workbook to go with that. And obviously, the material and the experience in the digital program is going to be far more robust. But can you just talk a little bit about the workbook and what that is and how that compares to eSense?
Yeah. So the Better Sex Through Mindfulness book, which was published in 2018, is really a synthesis of the science. Like, what is mindfulness? How does it apply to sexual concerns in women, and why does it work? So it's kind of an academic trade book, if you will. It's a translation of the science, because so often, as you know well, we write these elaborate, beautiful medical publications and
no one reads them.
Public, yeah. I always say 5 people read them, and those are my own students. And so my first book was really about taking that body of science and pushing it out into the world. And then what I found was so many women were reaching out saying, okay, I'm intrigued. How do I do it now? So then I wrote the workbook in 2022, which walks women through. So for years and years, we ran in-person 8-session groups targeting women with low desire, where we were delivering the mindfulness-based program. And so the workbook walks them through all of that. And then it's obviously adapted. It's not just for women with low desire, but it can be adapted to women who struggle sexually in other ways. There's an entire chapter on men, because we've done some research with men.
I wouldn't ignore the men, but you know.
But I'm going to throw it in there just in case. I know that you have men who are listening to this, because that's often a question.
Actually, 30% of listeners are men. So.
That's right. And
welcome, you know, guys.
Teaser, mindfulness works just as well for men with premature ejaculation or situational erectile dysfunction, where there's a lot of anxiety and kind of catastrophizing that are happening. So that's the workbook. And the workbook, what's been really wonderful for me to hear is the number of sex therapists that actually use the workbook as a way of kind of learning these methods themselves, and then in turn delivering it to their own patients, which is great. So eSense goes a step further, because you can do it on your own pace, in your own office, or in your own home. And it really is meant to simulate. So we want to hold the woman's hand as she's going through the exercises on her own. And then, because we offer a navigator, this optional few minutes a week check-in, that really increases their kind of adherence to the program.
Yeah. And I am sure that there's a fee involved with this. And I'm sure that the fee is probably less than one therapy session with
that is exactly it, Dr. Stryker. It's less than the cost of a single sex therapy session.
Yeah. And I think people need to keep that in mind. I don't know what the fee is. I don't know if you want to say what it is at this point. I know it's in beta, but
yeah. I can tell you it's $250 and most
Which
sex therapists.
Less than a sex therapy session.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's like bringing your sex therapist home with you. You get to refer back to it anytime you want, because once you have it, you have it. You can refer to it a year later. I mean, you're buying.
That's right.
Yeah. So of course, the perfect thing that this will accompany is my Come Again series, which is my 30 episode audio series, which goes through the biological, physical, and medical aspects of sexual response, because you need both. And I'm going to figure out a way to tag information on to my Come Again series, because while we talk about sex therapy a lot, this is a very, very specific tool that is going to make an enormous, enormous difference. So thank you. Thank you for doing this work and for making it available. I mean, the truth is the amount of work, and I know the amount of work that it takes to bring something like this to the public.
Yeah.
And it is not just incredibly, incredibly expensive, but it is also so time consuming. It just, I'm sure, how many years have you been working on this to bring this to the product?
10 years, Kyle and I have. And I mean, we've spent an entire week just figuring out tech questions. Like, you know?
No, it's enormous. So when people balk at a minimal cost like that, I think they need to appreciate the amount of time, work, and expertise that goes into it, and that you didn't have to do this, you know?
Yeah. And our mission was so clear to us from the outset. It was about closing a gap in access. Right. It was about taking these treatments and making them available.
I think when we talk about the gap in menopause care, which I talk about all the time, and the gap in clinical sexual medicine care, I think this gap may be even bigger.
Yeah. I mean, we have data that show us that when it comes to women with low desire in particular, and that's across ages, less than 20% will ever ask for help. It's interesting to, you know, because we're having such a great conversation around menopause, thanks to experts like you. Are women coming forward and talking about their sexual health concerns during menopause more now than they were before? I don't know. I hope someone's studying that. My hope is that they are studied.
And what we do know is that the majority of women who do talk about it when the clinician they're seeing brings it up.
That's right.
You know, because one hand they say, well, women don't bring it up because they're embarrassed. I honestly don't think women are embarrassed. I think they're waiting for the clinician to bring it up, but they also don't appreciate the fact that we have solutions for low libido, painful sex, and inability to orgasm, which brings me to my last question for you. As we've been talking a lot about low libido, and of course we know that that dealing with low libido is one step in terms of dealing with orgasmic dysfunction, the inability to have an orgasm, which is an area of interest for me. And we don't have time to talk about it today, so I'm just going to ask you a yes or no question. Are you doing work with orgasmic dysfunction, and can I bring you back to talk specifically about that?
Yes and yes.
Thank you.
Yes and yes, absolutely. And again, I love your series on orgasm, and I've referred a lot of my own patients to it, and it just so beautifully illustrates this kind of multidisciplinary approach around that. So yeah, would love to come back and talk about orgasms with you.
And before we end, because we are out of time, but I didn't give you a chance to just put anything out there that you just want people to know.
Yeah, I mean, I love this conversation, Dr. Stryker, because it shows how, you know, sexual health and sexual medicine doesn't belong to any one discipline. There's so many of us that are in the field doing the work and coming together. And this is the part that I love, is working. You know, I'm a psychologist in a department of OBGYN. Most of my colleagues are physicians. And we learn from each other. And importantly, we do the science, and we change
the science, and we rely on the science,
and we revise our understanding of the best treatment approach based on what the science says. So we need more funding in women's health, in women's sexual health, to advance the science so that we can continue to deliver really good care to women.
And amen to that. Thank you. Thank you for your work. And thank you for spending this hour with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.